Hello.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm truly sorry. We had a little personnel matter that came up just before you called that I had to deal with.
Well, that's good.
Well, it was successful, but it had to take attention.
Yeah.
And well, I apologize.
Well, no, it's all right. We're delighted we're able to link up. We've sent you some time ago some questions that we wanted to ask, and I'll review those questions again so to sort of refresh your memory. And
okay.
then you can add any other pieces of information that either relate to those or other topics you want to explore. The first is a kind of factual question, is just to confirm your date when you served as president at MSU. I have 1993 to 2004, is that right?
Right. I guess it was December 31st, 2004. September, okay. September 93.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, that's fine.
So, Peter, can I ask you a quick question about you becoming president?
Sure.
So, why did you apply? What were you doing at the time? And what were the key issues the Board of Trustees wanted you to handle? Were there certain kinds of things at that time that made, you know, that you were expected to take on?
Well, I was at Bank of America as a group executive vice president in San Francisco. It's true, my wife wondered why we'd moved to East Lansing where the weather was so much different and she had a house where she could see the bay. I had gone to, been an undergraduate at Michigan State. I had followed educational issues, been on a couple boards and that kind of thing, and of course it had read quite a lot. At AID, I'd been involved in a bunch of higher education issues. But going back home was very, and to the university you studied in, had enormous appeal. And the substance had appeal. I was interested in some of the free speech issues, for example. A range of questions. As you both know, universities are intellectually exciting places. It is interesting. At Bank of America, I hardly had any discussions about anything except banking in the 5 years I was there. Even though they're very smart people, but the change of environment to the vibrant intellectual culture of a big campus was enormously appealing.
Thank you. That makes sense.
What did the? You guys have lived in it all your professional life, but it's and appreciate the richness, and it's a real privilege to have that opportunity. And I could see that from the outside as something that I could really get into. What did the board want? As you remember, there was a failed search. They were stuck a bit. I think they found my financial background to be something that was appealing. At least some of the board members knew of my time in Washington, and I thought they felt that some small p political experience probably was pretty good. The board, if you both remember, was extremely divided at that time with deep public feuding factions. It was a little bit of a risk for me back at Bank of America to apply in it. The nature when I got really involved, a truncated search process was important because I had billions of dollars I had some responsibility for within the bank. That's more than you need, I'm sure, but there we are.
That was very interesting. I really appreciate it.
I had a I I don't know that the bank, I don't know that the university thought much about this, but having practiced law and being a lawyer was enormously helpful ultimately. Of course, once you're a lawyer, you never really stop being a lawyer in any job you're in. But in a myriad of ways, the law was helpful to me. The law, the finance, the sort of Washington experience, all those things were helpful. But as I remember, Bob, they kept referring to me as a banker.
Yep.
Even though I'd been only a banker for 5 years.
Yep, that's true.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on now to some of the questions. Let me just read them to you. In the your role as president, which is true of all presidents, you interacted with the faculty grievance policy in several ways: to recommend the appointment of a faculty grievance official to the board with advice from the provost and the university committee on faculty affairs on actions for salary adjustments and reappointments of FGOs, and in the event of an appeal of a provost decision on a grievance, to consider and render a final decision, as well as a whole variety of other issues you might have engaged in. Could you comment a bit on your involvement in and any issues confronted in these several roles?
Well, I think those technical functions weren't particularly complicated. I mean, the appointment, the compensation, those things. There were several major cases, some major cases that did get complicated where I was involved, in fact. And that perhaps is beyond your question, though. I'd be happy to get into those.
Oh, I think that's all right.
I mean, those things, those formal matters were fairly straightforward. There was a process and train that ran along. Immediately when I got there, and you'll remember his name, Bob, there was this professor who had sent graduate students into Sudan with dollars, hidden dollars, because of the currency exchange rate was such a problem. What was his name, Bob?
I don't recall it.
Yeah, we've been trying not to use grievance names.
Okay, well, anyway.
But if you want to say it.
We had this faculty member.
Right.
Who was doing medical research in Sudan, done good work for a long time. He had, the Sudanese government required dollars to be formally taken in, and then they would convert them at huge loss, the government, huge loss to local currency. And this is not an uncommon thing for developing countries to do, but the loss was so enormous, and the faculty member found he couldn't sustain the budget, the activity he needed, he wanted, with the project needed to meet the goals. He then used some graduate students that were working for him on the project to essentially bring in dollars. I don't know how well you want to write all this down in your report. Maybe not, but probably not.
It's fascinating.
And I, having worked a lot with foreign currencies and knowing Sudan pretty well, actually, I had some real understanding, but it had been a huge battle. Grieving back and forth, it almost had tied up that whole process. I know, Bob, you have to remember this, in the end, and the university was at a position where I got there where nobody felt they could really almost talk to this faculty member without creating a grievance in some way. And I don't know, it was foolhardy it seemed prudent to me, since I'd been totally uninvolved. I sat down with him in my den at Cole's house, and basically we worked out what were going to be the next steps and settled the case.
Wow.
That was, and it and it really took it off the table. I think that was in my first 3 or 4 months, actually.
So at that time, Mike Rubner was the FGO.
Yes.
So he had been dealing with this issue, having people from the department, the administration, talk to him, and maybe the faculty member?
Oh, yes. This had been a couple years old, with increasing bitterness on all sides. Bitterness on the part of the faculty member, for sure, but unhappiness by the administration. And it was clear they weren't going to get anywhere, at least it seemed that way to me. And I wasn't perhaps as cautious of all the rules and processes. I thought, geez, let me just sit down with this man and see if I can figure it out.
And
it worked.
It worked. Great.
Good. Okay. Let's move on to another question.
Wait a second then. There were parts of Bob's question I don't think we sort of got to. So you said many things, the train ran on its own, or the whatever, how you phrased it exactly.
Right. I mean, there was people came to me with, here's what needs to be done, and here's how it works, and that kind of thing. That's what I meant.
And so when you referred to, well, Bob, you'd know this or that, I'm assuming what you're saying is the president didn't, on most cases, get very involved. That was deferred to the step below the president, which would be the provost and the provost assistant associate.
Absolutely.
So you would talk to Luana Simon, who was provost at the time, or her assistant, Bob Banks, who was academic HR?
Yes, I speak as if he's not on the phone. Banks was very helpful.
You're not.
As I recall it, now this has been a long time ago.
Right.
1993, 1994. It wasn't one of those things that seemed to me, nor was it called to my attention as needing a great deal of my personal focus.
Mm-hmm.
There were formal actions, as I remember, but that was it. This case I just got into clearly did require my attention.
Understood. Thank you.
So what John has asked sort of shifts into the third question, which is, on whom did you rely for advice? And you've talked about Luana and my role. The related question, particularly, I think, probably more significant at the time you were there than earlier, is the Office of the General Counsel, maybe the General Counsel himself, in terms of playing a substantial role in providing advice on these matters. And if you could talk a little bit about formal appeal hearings, which I assume you had during the course of your assignment as president. In other words, one of the parties, usually a faculty member, appealed the provost's decision in a grievance and then decided to appeal it to you. How did you go about addressing that particular set of issues?
No question, legal counsel was an important source of advice, and there were always pretty extensive documents.
Uh-huh.
As I recall, it was appropriate for me to talk to you and Simon, depending upon the case.
So my ignorance here, is Bob Noto in the job at that point or someone else?
No, we had I hired Noto a year or two into my being there. A woman who went to Texas.
Yeah, Mary Beth Kurz.
Mary Beth Kurz,
yeah.
My first general counsel.
Yeah.
Let me just put it this way. Noto was from my point of view, just an excellent help and lawyer.
Understood.
Noto was, this was Noto's kind of thing, actually.
I don't know if Bob told you all the people we've interviewed, but we did interview Bob Noto off the record and then on the record. Again, not talking about particular cases, but sort of the process and his relationship to Luana or presidents in the process. And then we also talked to Christine Zako some similarly.
Good.
Okay. So can we move along? Generally, from your perspective as president, how in terms of your experience in that role, how has the faculty grievance policy worked in terms of its overall strengths and weaknesses in addressing issues and in resolving disputes? And in general terms, what are its strengths and weaknesses? We'll come back to this in a moment. And I want to ask you about a particular set of questions and issues related to that. But could you comment on that general topic?
Well, I think it's got real problems. I mean, I think the idea that you can grieve a decision maker and then keep on appealing the grieving just struck me. The idea that, and this is true with universities around the country, we are deeply interested in process fairness. And in our pursuit of fairness, I think we can often stumble into unfairness because of the process, because it takes too long, because the very process and the cumbersome and contentiousness of it defeats the fairness in which you pursue. I think as a community, our desire to be fair, which is certainly a sound basis for in a courtroom due process and that whole concept, then translate into a process procedural fairness for all parties. In itself, it seemed to me, and because of the way we were set up, had the potential of really defeating and did often defeat. You see that in universities around the country, so I hope you guys do more than just make comments at the margins. I think there's some real problems here. Now, remember, I'm not a technician in this area, and it's been a long time since I've had any real engagement in it. But one of the things that I always thought was a problem was how a dean decides a grievance case, which is fine if the faculty member appeals it to the next level. But you can't grieve the dean because of the way it's like a judge decides a case and then it's appealed. Then you're supposed to grieve the judge who made the first level decision, unless there was something truly wrong with the judge's behavior. There's no way you could do that. Bob, we discussed the other day the person from the medical school. What was his name?
Andy Hogan. You know, Andy Hogan.
I mean, remember that deal? He kept on grieving decision makers.
Yeah.
Jesus, I thought, what the hell is this? And he was able to grieve them and tie up the process on the most on tangents. You got to fix that. Think about compare it to a judge there at a court in East Lansing, when you could essentially have the equivalence of a grievance against a local judge. If he had some conflict of interest that was clear and direct, had a financial interest in the case or something, you could do that, but very limited. And you really ought to fix that.
So
that's my view.
That makes great sense.
You guys could be a leader in this, because around the country, periodically, I hear about these cases that just make my head shake. I think it comes back to a deep interest on fairness, and And people forget that justice delayed or justice skewed can have as much impact as anything.
So I'm going to interject for a second. So when I was when I started as FGO in July of 2004, I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but there were about four dozen cases, and half of the cases were the two gentlemen who I later called the frequent filers. And they clearly, for slightly different stories, and you named one, and another person wasn't quite as busy as the one you named, did exactly what you're saying. They would grieve first lowest level, the chair, whatever, and then they would grieve the dean, and then they would grieve Bob Banks, and then they might grieve, in fact, they did grieve the FOIA officer, Christine Zako, then they grieved Luana, then they grieved you, and the one gentleman then sent every professor on campus his side of the story, so to speak, state senators. It was unbelievable.
Right.
It took me about 18 months, and those two were out of the system completely. And as far as I know, we haven't quite had a story as unfortunate as that process. But
I think if you can go back and say to yourself and look at circumstances where the process, by its complexity and opportunities it presents, defeats fairness, it'd be a worthy conceptual framework.
And so besides doing these interviews of all the FGOs, the general counsels, the presidents and provosts, and some other people involved, we also have this one component that we're trying to develop a survey for the Academic Alliance, and Bob might mention this a little later, where we're asking how are they handling their non-union grievance dispute complaint issues. Trying to say something, we want to capture the history of this because it's almost 50 years old, but also be able to say something in terms of strengths and weaknesses of this kind of non-union grievance procedure, whatever, for faculty.
I have a feeling though that many universities don't do a very good job on this actually, and despite enormous efforts like of people like you. I mean, I think this is this is ripe for change.
Well,
so when we get something written up, we'll send it your way so you can make comments and help us along.
This is why I look forward to this call, because I wanted to make my point, which I guess I'll stop making since I've made it three times.
It's very helpful, though. Thank you.
So let me turn back to a little bit of history, which is interesting in a number of respects. I'm looking at Mike Rubner's annual report of the faculty grievance policy for the period May 1993 through May 1994. And in it, he says, in early fall semester of 1993, President McPherson requested the UCFA and the Office of the Provost to consider three items for the purpose of recommending amendments to the FGP or other university policies. And I just stop there to say that this is, in a sense, not improper, but unusual. If we look at all the presidents that we've talked to, and we talked briefly on the phone the other week, we haven't talked to President DiBiagio, but all the others, which would be Cliff Wharton and Luana, and then now yourself, you would be the only one that directly engaged in proposing ideas that should be considered. So I think that's interesting. But the issues...
I don't remember what my ideas were.
Well, I'm going to tell you what the ideas were. Because Michael wrote all these out. One, creating a procedure to permit front-end appeal of jurisdictional disagreements between parties to grievances with a speedy resolution by the president. Number two, create mechanisms to ensure that multiple grievances, complaints, and other proceedings contemporaneous with the faculty grievance policy are not permitted. And thirdly, revising the university's indemnification policy by including relevant language related to the adjudication of grievances by hearing panels and the FGO. Those are the lists.
Okay.
Now, that's Michael's list. That may not be correct, but that's what he believed you were asking people to look at that point.
I'm sure it is. They're in the spirit of what I've been talking about.
Yeah. And so why, in terms of that particular range or plethora of issues, did you pick those three out? Because they're fairly specific that focus on aspects of
the
procedure.
Well, I had that immediate experience with the professor who had worked in Sudan that I'm sure gave me some of these ideas. That was before Andy. I'm sorry that I don't remember all the details of this.
We wouldn't, if we weren't going to the archives and pulling up these documents, be able to name any of this sort of thing. So it's a very long time ago.
But, you know, I like process procedures as a lawyer. I'm not surprised I got right into it.
Well, too interesting.
Which is a little inconsistent with my thinking to train right along with my, without my being deeply engaged. I guess I was engaged.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you two other things about that, or make one other comment, but asking one other thing. There was a case in which your predecessor, Gordon Geyer, who was there as an interim between John A. DiBiagio and yourself, coming for a short period of time, actually engaged in setting aside a grievance. It was in the middle of a process proceeding, and he said, no, we're just going to stop this. Now, I'm trying to find out with historical review what led him to do that, but one of the items that was raised that he declared, and he did this in a letter to the FGO, since this panel was deliberating on crafting a set of recommendations which would go to the provost for a decision, he said, if you continue to do that, I'm going to have your indemnification coverage withdrawn. And so Michael and Luana went and talked with him, and I think talked him in the event out of doing that. The University Committee on Faculty Affairs considered all these items that he'd raised and deliberated and passed some resolutions. And then, interestingly, we had a long period from the mid-70s up until the 90s of having no amendments to the grievance procedure, and this provoked a significant array of amendments, which, again, in terms of the history of all of this, said that there would be a constraint on internal and external proceedings, so there would be a process that says you couldn't have a grievance and then go to court. You had to choose one or the other.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes.
That was introduced. And then there was
that was a key provision, actually.
Yeah, that hadn't existed in the policy before. Secondly, was the resolution of jurisdictional matters, which was a process, while the FGO, and John can fill in on this, from his perspective, worked largely informally on dealing with issues like, was the grievance filed in a timely fashion? Did it relate to the right person that should respond, et cetera, et cetera? In fact, there was a process of working out all these topics out that the FGO had to opine on and produce a decision. And then if there was a problem, there was a three-person faculty panel that considered an appeal if someone believed that they were treated unfairly, that had very short timeline for turnaround so that you cleared the decks and got to work with a grievance that was operational as opposed to the one that was not. And then the last item was to put actually in the grievance procedure, because the board had passed years ago a kind of opinion on covering folks under the indemnification policy if they were performing university business, and it was made an explicit reference to people's role as they pursued their responsibilities under the grievance procedure. So perhaps this may be overly extreme, but from my perspective, the fact that you raised those questions, which were important questions, and within about a year and a half, there was deliberations, an action frame, and they came forward from the committee to academic council to the provost to you and the board and actually got put in the procedure. So in some respects, your initiation had some positive benefits to, in terms of clarifying the procedure. So that's a little bit of history that you may not be don't remember or don't are not aware of the significance.
Yeah, I don't remember it, but I, as you talk about it, I began to recall some of it. I think that Gordon's actions dealt with the sedan guy, by the way.
Possibly. I think there was another person who was involved, but that's something.
There was this idea of not being able to go to court after you had to choose your venue.
Yeah.
Was a key thing, critical thing.
Okay.
Just a quick follow-up long after you had left. A major revision of sorts in some parts came up during my time, and it was passed by the board in August of 2009. And related to what Bob was just talking about, part of the change was to beef up or direct the FGO to more thoroughly make decisions on jurisdictional matters and to require more specificity by a grievant in stating what exactly is the policy or practice that you say has been violated. What exactly are you asking for a resolution to this? And saying clearly to the FGO, you need to do that. And if the party then wants to appeal, they can appeal the FGO's decision. And in the annual reports the FGO writes, which we've looked at, I might have had from 4 to 8 of these a year, and about 4 or 8 jurisdictional decisions, and maybe half of those got appealed, and almost, I believe, every single one was by the grievant, and maybe half of those the FGO's upheld and half the FGO wasn't, and so then it did go to a hearing. But it did mean that many fewer things went on to the provost.
Good for you. Good for you.
Okay, well, there's a question on lessons learned and any suggestions for change, which we'll come back to. Let me go on to another one. Do you have any comments on the character and quality of your relationships with the faculty of grievance officials in place during your presidency, which would largely be Michael Rubner, and then a short period of time before you finished off your presidency with John Rivette? John can put his head down or put his hands over his ears
or leave the room, whatever.
I
think they were sound. I appreciate John's work. And I had that long period of Rubin who I thought was careful and thoughtful. I have nothing but positive recollections.
Okay. So let's talk, John.
Number seven, I think, is where you're at.
Well, no, I'm actually at number 5, which is asking about
just finished the FGOs.
Okay. We talked a bit about these few amendments that emerged in the previous interchange from your initiative to say, well, we should really be looking at these sorts of things and ask that they proceed. Do you have any other sense of major changes in the procedure that are not included in that set that you have views on one way or the other?
I don't really.
I don't think that there are all many of them, but apart from that set.
I don't remember the procedures in any detail. I do, as I say, periodically see universities jerk around people that in a way that I think is really egregious. case I remember most recently. You remember this woman at Northwestern, a faculty member who had some problems under Title IX. Forgotten all the detail. That was 2-3 years ago, mm-hmm. but it had nothing to do with her behavior. She said something that was thought by someone to be inflammatory, and she got grieved, and she went through under a Title IX rule, and on. It sounds like we've done some key good things there at Michigan State. I just hope we continue to work hard at making processes not too elaborate and prompt and so on and so forth.
Okay.
It reminds me of the tax code. Every time there's a problem, we write an extra 30 pages of regulation, which in turn causes a new question someplace, and then there's another 30 pages.
Yeah. For good or ill, it's interesting to note that the policy was adopted in 1972, and in the first 3 or 4 years, as you would expect in a brand new policy that had really not been formulated before, and as best we can tell, it may have been the first kind of policy developed in any of the Big Ten schools. We've now looked at what they're doing, and we want to ask your sense about that. But they have sort of caught up, for good or ill, with a lot of the policies that were developed. And after the first 2 or 3 years, the FGOs really worked to exercise their role in terms of interpreter of the procedure. And there were a lot of issues that had just never been thought about that largely arose in the case of particular grievances. But after about the mid-1970s, until those amendments that I talked about in the 90s, there were essentially no changes in the procedure. So for good or ill, it seemed to work pretty well, but there were these particular issues that you had raised and others had raised that needed to be addressed. So that's a kind of historical perspective. So, any
are there other questions?
Yeah, there are a couple more.
And I have one more. So,
John had mentioned that we're, as part of this study, we're trying to craft a survey that asks the other Big Ten Academic Alliance universities what they are doing in terms of essentially non-union faculty and academic staff grievance procedures. And our question is, was this topic of these procedures, the concerns, the issues, and so on that related to them, ever discussed in your meetings with the Big Ten presidents or other forums?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't have any recollection of that. And they, where it would have been discussed if it was in the provost Big Ten meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Might well have been discussed there.
Yeah, I think there was comments. Luana would be the main commentator in terms of all of that. So the last are sort of general questions, but John has a question you want to raise.
Yeah, but it's off topic of the FGP, so let Bob finish his.
These are just a couple of questions. Says, any lessons apart from the issues you've raised already from your experience in administering the faculty grievance policy, and any suggestions for change? You've already talked about this general set of topics.
I don't have anything more.
Okay.
So can I have 2 minutes more of your time?
It'd be great fun. It'd be interesting to. But it'd be fun to run my fingers through all this a little bit. I'm not suggesting I do, because I'm sure I'd have more views.
Yeah. Sure.
Go ahead.
John.
Off the FGP, but if you could have a couple more minutes. When you reflect back on your decade or 11 years at MSU, what were the key challenges and key issues you already said when you came on they had certain things going on in the board in terms of being divided and so forth. How would you sort of summarize your time here? And I'm sure you've spoke to other groups about it, but I'm curious how you would summarize it.
Well, some really nice big successes and some problems, of course. It's, you know, 11 years, it seems like I saw everything and experienced everything from having mass vaccinations for the campus at one point to a football investigation within a few months after I got there, the NCAA, a new law school, lots of buildings. I mean, it's like when you run something for a long time, you see lots of things, some things that you wish you'd done differently and some things that worked out well. Maybe that's too general a response.
That's fine. I just... curious.
I'm really glad I was there for those many years. And I think I tell my colleagues here that at this juncture we APLU has virtually averaged Carnegie 1 and 2 in the country and all the land grants. And so I know virtually every big public university president, and of course there's lots of discussions. And I think people ought to stay a while. Too often they change too quickly.
And that kind of goes right into my other question. I don't know a great deal about your land grant association and what exact work you do there. Bob answered when I asked him a little bit about it, but could you briefly summarize what?
Sure. Our membership is what I've just said. When I got here now a year after I left APLU, after I left Michigan State, we were largely focused on as a kind of a convener and on some key legislative issues. We're now really much bigger, much broader. It's a budget of about $18 million, 70 people, a new big effort. A lot of work on degree completion, a huge new effort we rolled out last November is we have 130 institutions divided into clusters of about 10 each. They're working together to increase their degrees, particularly low-income minority students, a bunch of Gates money. But that's 3 million undergraduates in those schools. But there is a Big Ten grouping. Michigan State is not part of that because you're part of this UIA that started a few years ago, but certainly is committed to these principles. The range of activity is quite substantial. A lot of good stuff that, of course, I learned there at Michigan State. For example, 2 years ago, we put together a task force to look at what we should recommend in connection with feeding antibiotics to the animals for growth. I got Dean King to help me put this together, who has since gone to the CDC and then to Ohio State. Something King and I talked about when I was on campus. Feeding antibiotics to animals creates resistance to antibiotics, of course, and it's a real problem. And we're about ready to have a task force to look at gene editing in animals. Mm. So we do that kind of stuff, but it's the whole range of, we're deeply involved in the Title IX stuff, the new regulation the department has proposed, on and on. It's a pretty exciting, driven place. Great people. Howard Gobstein is here with me. He's a person that maybe you remember.
Oh, yeah. He was that Washington liaison guy.
Yes.
For
he's
MSU.
Been here since I came.
And you came in 05? In
yes.
January of 05?
No, January 06. I left Michigan State December 31st, 04. So it was a year later.
Okay.
Exactly, a year later.
So you've...
So I'm having fun, and I'm only 78 years old, so what the heck, I got... I told my board I'd do it 3 more years in January, last January.
Sounds great.
One last question. Thanks. Did I send you a release form that we need to do for putting this into the Voice Libraries collection? And if not, should I just send it to the email address?
Yeah, just send it to email, and I'll get it back to you.
Okay.
Okay, that's good.
Thank you so very much. This was very informative, a lot of fun.
Thank you for your time. Good luck to you.
You bet. Bye. Bye.